Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Leonard Barkin. He is the class of 1943 University Professor of Comparative Literature at Princeton University, and we're talking about his book, The Hungry Eye, Eating, Drinking, and European Culture from Rome to the Renaissance. Leonard, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
The pleasure is mine, Mark. This is a great opportunity.
I love books that I thought were going to be one thing and turned out to be a whole other thing. I think a lot of people, like reading the title and looking at the beautiful painting on the cover, think, oh, this is just going to be a picture book of sumptuous food paintings. And I think they'd be in for a real surprise because this is not that kind of a book. This is not even a history of gastronomy. It's a very complex book, a very funny book, and an all-around interesting book. What prompted you? What brought you into this realm of writing this?
Well, you know, one has to start by the fact that I love to cook and to eat and to taste wine. And I've been doing that, since seriously and occasionally in one way or another professionally since I was in college. It's a long, long time. So there's that, and that, it seems to me, almost all the books I've written, and I've written quite a lot of books, have an element that's very personal about them, even though I'm a scholar, I'm a professor at Princeton, I teach in various departments, I have a scholarly approach to things, but whether on the surface or deep down, the books I write are about what I'm passionate about. I love food. I love cooking. I also love the visual arts. My training is in literature, but most of my work these days is in the history of art. So that aspect of the book with beautiful pictures of food.
By the way, I should add, there are a lot of beautiful pictures about food in this book. But that's only as illustrations for the text. This is a book, and I want you to explain this for the audience, and this is your phrase, reading for the food. And I love that phrase. So this is a book, reading for the food.
You know, it was at some point going to be the title of the book, and it just didn't feel quite like a bankable title. So it's been demoted to the title of the first chapter. There are sort of two elements here. One is sort of an obvious one, which is to say food is everywhere. It's in everyone's life. It's in every part of history and so on. But the other side is that it is often pushed to the side.
Right.
I mean, it's so inevitable. Why talk about it? So that project that's signaled in the phrase reading for the food is to say I'm looking at things, at stories, works of art, historical moments, whatever they are, that don't appear to be about the food. And I'm saying, well, you know, when they were, burning down the Bastille, what did they have for dinner? I don't, in fact, talk about the burning of the Bastille. But, you know, whatever it is, whether it's the Roman Empire or Christians' observance, whatever it is, what are they eating? What's the food angle? Plato's Symposium, it's a drinking party.
Right.
Let's talk about the fact that it's a drinking party. The definition of love is great, and it's at the center. But, you know, one person gets the hiccups, another one comes in drunk. what's up with that?
Well, it is interesting. And this is one of the central themes of your book, is that when paintings or literature – like the Symposium, talks about food, it always stands for something else other than the food.
Exactly.
And food, as you write about in this book, is probably one of the most basic experiences that all humans have. And we all can relate to it. It brings us all the way back to our first sense of pleasure as a child. It is
Absolutely.
This incredibly important experience, yet it is pushed to the side. And I want to give an example and talk about one of the paintings. And I think this discussion in your book is a really good example of where this book goes. There's a François Boucher painting, 1947. And the title of the painting is, Are They Thinking About Grapes? Now, you have to paint a picture of what this painting is like. Talk about the painting first.
Well, it's a painting. It's a sort of pastoral painting, and the male and female characters are to be understood as somehow as fancied up shepherds.
Yeah.
And the gentleman is gracefully handing out to the, again, gracefully sort of shepherdess-dressed lady, a grape. But they're also looking into each other's eyes. And Boucher actually gave it this title. It's not something it came after. Are they thinking of the grapes? And, of course, the answer is no. They're thinking of, well, let's put it politely, love, sex, whatever. And, you know, I say, well, what happens if maybe they're not thinking of the grapes, but I am?
I can't believe you said that. I think that was the time that I knew that this book was going to take me weird places, that you said clearly you would be thinking about the grapes.
Right. And, of course, grapes have an enormous cultural resonance, not
sure.
only wine and the Eucharist and so on, where I go down that road very heavily.
Oh, my
in
God.
The latter stages of the book. But also the famous, I mean, for a painter, the famous story about, you know, Apelles and Protogenes and, you know, the painting of the grapes that birds flew down and pecked at because they thought they were real grapes. And that was a sign of the achievement of the artist, was the perfect rendition of grapes.
Well, that brings up another theme in your book, which is about the idea of reality.
Yes.
And how reality resonates in both works of art and in works of literature. And there's a great example that you give in the book, and it's an important work that keeps coming up right until the end. There's a mosaic, I think by Heraclitus of Rome, of the second century.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know exactly who, but that's the name usually given, yes.
And it is an I was familiar with this mosaic from before, and we call it unswept floor mosaic. It's this
right.
incredible mosaic of what a floor would look like after a rollicking party. It's all bits of food. There's
right.
a mouse
eating.
It's garbage. It's a mouse eating one.
Garbage.
But it's got in a mosaic right. yet. It's got a shadows on every single piece.
That's
but
right.
it's the illusion of reality.
For me, the unswept floor is sort of the emblem of my project. In so many different ways. I mean, it's an incredible work of art. It lives at the Vatican, and people can get there. And so it was the mosaic floor of a grand dining room. And, of course, the whole thing is a joke. You know, the guests come in to the dinner that they have not yet eaten, and it looks as though, and it's extremely good trompe-l'oeil. I mean, and one of my theories, it really sort of came to me more or less once after I'd finished the book, is that in the ages of the visual arts that did great food painting, which is late antiquity and, say, the Dutch 17th century, often the painting of food is so much more realistic than the painting of anything else that is being painted at the same time. It's as though uniquely there was a kind of photographic standard for painting food, whereas the painting of portraits or religious subjects or battles, you know, it was very fanciful. It doesn't look real to us. The food looks real to us. So these people come into this dining room, and there's already apparently been a dinner there, and the garbage hasn't been cleared away. But of course, the garbage is this masterpiece of beautiful mosaic production, and of course, it's incredibly difficult to do these things in little tiny pieces of,
oh, yeah.
you know, of dreck from the, you know, from the sand pile. But it, you know, and that sense that food is can be beautiful, but it's also can be considered waste. That range is very important to the book. That has to do, as you were talking about, it has to do with the question of its being all important at the same time as it is being sort of, you know, shunted to the side as a not important cultural activity. It's sort of a necessity rather than either something essential to power or something essential to pleasure or whatever the goals are. Food is kind of a sideline. And
well,
again, I wrote the book because it's not a sideline.
you have an entire chapter about ancient Roman art, and it's interesting because it's different from in tone and the subject matter from all the rest of the chapters, because in Roman art it looks like they're totally comfortable. Painting or doing mosaics of food. Food itself is important.
Exactly, and that's sort of the strategy of that chapter. Excuse me, is to say, okay, this is the counterexample. This is a culture in which food was accepted as something very central. And all the remains of that culture, whether historical or literary, remind us that it wasn't shunted to the sidelines. I talk a lot about Roman satire and how central the scene of dining is.
Oh, yeah.
It is, culture is dinner parties. Power, the sort of imperial, holding the empire together, was banquets. You know, high art was still life. So this is the, you know, the example against which to set what is fundamentally a post-classical world, where food is part of the, you know, the kind of denigration of the body, is, you know, the denigration of the body is, it's either sex or food, and neither of those topics is entirely respectable. I'm kind of teasing out how where it was respectable.
Well, this is all part of reading for food, and it's really fascinating when you start doing that, when you start looking at representations of the Madonna and Child and paying attention to what what food is there, or the Last Supper, or and there's a lot of other examples I want to talk about, but we're staying on Rome. What are zinnias? X-E-N-I-A's. Fascinating.
It's a great, it was the habit, and this is, we're talking about late antiquity, like 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries. It was the habit as part of a, and I think eventually it became sort of vestigial, and I'm not sure they were really performed that way, but the notion was if one was invited to dinner, one was presented with a picture painted or in mosaic of some enticing food article, implied that it might be served or might be part of the production of that dinner. And since the scene of being invited to dinner was of a traveler and much, I mean, starting with the Odyssey, ancient literature is often about travelers or Apuleius' Golden Ass and so on. So the scene of being invited to dinner was that you were a stranger in a city, and the right people who wanted to receive you would invite you to dinner. But they would invite you with a series of steps. They would actually send you some raw food to where you were lodging, or they would send you a poem about a piece of food. But ultimately, they would send you a picture of food, of, you know, typically beautiful fruits or vegetables or fish on a plate or grapes, to go back to grapes. And this was sort of the symbolic sign that you were welcomed to dinner. And again, putting at the center of what dinner meant the food you're going to eat, not just the fun you'd have and the meeting people and so on, but the food you were going to eat. That was the sign of hospitality.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Leonard Barkin. He's the class of 1943 University Professor of Comparative Literature at Princeton University. And we're talking about his book. It's one. It's a great read. It's beautiful to look at, too, but it's a great read. The Hungry Eye, Eating, Drinking, and European Culture from Rome to the Renaissance. One of the most fascinating chapters that really sent me off on a great tangent was the chapter on fooding the Bible. Food's all, as you write, food is all over the Bible. What's the difference between fooding the Bible and food in the Bible?
Well, I like that question.
Well, you wrote it.
Food in the Bible is a sort of taxonomy. A list of, Abraham came, you know, with cartloads of very specifically listed, you know, edibles and so on. So food in the Bible is a taxonomy. Fooding the Bible is saying what happens when instead of food being on the margins of these stories, which are obviously about the very grandest matters, not they don't represent themselves as centrally about food. But what happens when we say we're going to read the Bible for the food?
It really changes your perspective and understanding of looking at these works of art. Right. You start out with Titian's painting, Presentation of the Virgin at the Temple. I would never have looked at it this way, except for your book. There's this incredible, involved, beautiful painting, but in the foreground, and actually, as you write, dramatically situated with her white kerchief or a white... is an egg seller.
Yes. and I began the chapter there because it's such a wonderful instance.
Well, once you start fooding the way you look, it is weird.
Right. And in no way has anything to do with presentation of the Virgin. It's completely, sometimes there are certain many biblical paintings, and I talk about them, that are somehow about a meal, and so it's not surprising that the artist might paint a meal. But this is in no way about selling eggs.
The artist just obviously stuck this egg seller in the front of the painting, essentially.
Right, and it's also because the painting it's a rare instance of a painting that is now exactly where it was painted to be in Venice, and this figure. As is often the case, for example, with those Madonna and Child paintings that have food in them.
Yeah.
The food aspect is way in the foreground, is kind of on the threshold between the painting and the viewer. And it's what draws us in, what not only in a visual sense, but what unites us, because we may not be present in front of the real Madonna and Child, but we are present in front dinner.
Well, this, as you collect in the book, there's a whole genre that I think you call the Antwerp genre, where
of course,
where the whole painting is essentially about food cooking or preparation of food, and in a tiny scene in the background is the religious scene, and it's really weird when you start looking at a lot of them because it's really about the food. And in the background, there's some religious stuff going on.
Right. I mean, background is already makes it sound more prominent.
It's not even that. Right. It's like you're looking out your back door at a distance at something happening across the yard, and there's this religious scene. What an odd thing. And the fact that you collected these in the book really presents it as a whole genre.
It's important, yes. I mean, that is the strategy of the book, is to say, is to read for the food, and to notice sometimes you have to read very carefully. I mean, in the Symposium, the fact that Aristophanes gets the hiccups, you might not notice that. But, in these sort of Antwerp paintings that are supposedly, say, the rest on the flight in Egypt, where you'd have to go with a magnifying glass to see the rest on the flight into Egypt. What you don't have to use a magnifying glass for is a gigantic, country fair of vegetables and fruits, and often somebody preparing them or cooking or the fireplace or roasting. And then, of course, you have religious scenes like the Feast of Herod, the Salome and the head of John the Baptist story. There, it's much, what can I say, kinkier, because
it is.
The New Testament says in no uncertain terms that Salome wants the head of John the Baptist on a platter. And no matter, that's the English translation, but it's always a word for something you serve food on. And so it is a banquet, and all these paintings are, there are people with platters that have, pastrami or whatever, and, fruit. And there's one person who has a platter with a head on it.
I know, when you read it for food, it starts to get, as you mentioned, kinky or just bizarre.
Right.
There's so much I want to talk to you about this book, and we're not going to have enough time. I want to talk to you about the Mary and Martha.
Yes.
Let me tell you, I talked to a lot of my Catholic friends. they never heard of the story of Mary and Martha.
Uh-huh. Well, it used to be.
It's like a prominent theme in paintings of that period.
And it used to be. I mean, I did a lot of work on it, not only in my, pre-modern periods, but just sort of Googling that. And it's clear that it's up until recently. It's interesting that your friends don't know it, because I think in, say, the first half of the 20th century, it was often I'm not a Catholic, so I can't speak of this personally, but it was often an exemplum, especially to girls.
I can see
and
that.
I found these old sort of, memorial thing, you know, things that you might be handed in Sunday school, as I imagine it. Because this is sort of Mary is the you know, Jesus comes to the house of Mary and Martha. Mary sits at his feet. Martha, and the Bible is very vague about what she does, is busy about much effort or something vague like that, always construed as the fact that while Mary was sitting at his feet, Martha was making dinner.
I know. It's all about the food.
That's right.
And these artist renditions of the Mary and Martha story. And what's weird is that when you start looking at a bunch of them, you start thinking like, well, why the hell can't Mary help out in the kitchen? You know.
Well, that's exactly what Mary said. What Martha says, she complains to Jesus. Why am I doing this all by myself? And Jesus has this kind of complicated answer that
I'm not happy with that answer.
No, I'm not entirely clear even what it means. I mean, Martha, you're doing many things. Mary is busy about one thing, or Martha's busy about many things. Mary is doing one thing, and that's of the greatest importance. Obviously, the one thing is sitting at the feet of Jesus. And this is a problematic, then, from St. Augustine on, sort of, no one is quite sure how to accept that claim. And, of course, I'm always amused, and I think I say it in the book, who hasn't? I mean, I am a very happily married person, and when my spouse and I are making dinner, it's one of the first things that's liable to happen, that one of us say to I say to him or he says to me, you're not doing enough work on this.
If you're entertaining somebody and it's like one of you is spending time with
Right. It's a problem. Because, your guest, you don't want to leave the guest alone, especially if it's Jesus, for God's sake. But this gets turned into some kind of story about earthly work and heavenly work. Let's put it in that very general and vague sense. But for the artists, it's a story about, the kitchen.
It is.
There is Jesus.
And this poor Martha, and she's really like cooking up a storm. She's making bread. She's doing all this. And depending upon the artist, she's doing all these different like really tough like kitchen stuff. Yeah. And it's like.
Right. And Mary's just sitting there.
Yeah, I know. And as a person who's hosted people, I'm not really appreciative of the fact.
Right. But we know from the context of, the Bible, we know we're supposed to be sort of rooting for Mary, but in the kitchen?
Well, it seems like the artists are rooting for Martha in the kitchen too.
Absolutely, because there's so much more exciting to to look at what she's doing than look at somebody sitting at the feet, just sitting. And it's interesting. I don't know that I even noticed this when I was writing the book, but now talking about the book and looking at the Vermeer, the great Vermeer painting, he goes away from that. I mean, they are both attended to by, Martha is bringing in a beautiful loaf of bread, but she is paying attention to Jesus. Jesus is looking at the one and gesturing toward the other. Clearly, he said, I've got to bring about a sort of combination. I've got to see both of them. And that's what often the moral of the story was, that both of these efforts, not only the literal ones in that story, but whatever they're attached to, let's say, the works of daily life and the, faithfulness to God, that they both have a place. And that, starting with St. Augustine on, that sort of pluralistic reading was made. But, of course, as you say, the painters, sitting, schmitting, big deal, You can have, she's carrying a dead duck. She has a bowl of fruit. She has a fireplace going with pots and pans. That's reading for the food.
There is so much to talk about in this book, and we just have literally minutes left. And you pose this question in your book. What's the difference between a professional humanist and a professional chef?
Well, they, of course, in my book, they come together. And they're really.
So they're neither Martha nor Mary.
That's
they're
right.
Both.
They're both, or something like that. There is a. One of the great Renaissance humanists wrote a cookbook. This is not. I had a wonderful, as an undergraduate at Swarthmore, wonderful seminar on the Renaissance, on Renaissance humanism. No one mentioned Platina, who wrote a cookbook, a cookbook that went into 15 editions within 50 years, whereas his humanist writing sort of, you know, dropped like a dead weight. And he was a revolutionary humanist in the sense that he was imprisoned. He operated during a time when the pope, it sort of varied from one pope to another, but humanism was very suspect for all sorts of logical reasons. It wasn't always so very sort of God-centered. But he produced this remarkable cookbook. The recipes he mostly stole from a professional cook, you know, that worked with Italian noble families. But the idea of the cookbook was a celebration of God's plenty, but he doesn't even put it, you know, in that religious set of terms. More a celebration of commensality. I mean, I always like to say sort of taste, nourishment, commensality. That's food. And I wish I had a more common word for commensality. That is to say, the pleasure of eating together. Mensa being table, being together at the table. And so taste, nutrition, commensality, that's the triad for food, for the celebration of food. And Platina really, you know, in the cookbook, he talks about remembering meals he's had with his friends, some of whom are in prison at this point or dead or exiled. And what he ate with them. But also, it's too bad that so-and-so, and he gives them sort of funny names so you can't easily identify them. But, you know, he shouldn't have eaten so much of this because it gave him gas. I mean, it's very detailed. So these recipes are his friends. And it's all recollected from a moment afterwards.
Leonard, we're going to have to end. We've run out. We've unspun the reel here.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, wait a minute. My guest tonight has been Leonard Barkin. He is the class of 1943 University Professor of Comparative Literature at Princeton University. And we've been talking about his book. As you can tell, we've only scratched the surface of it. There's a lot in here. The Hungry Eye, Eating, Drinking, and European Culture from Rome to the Renaissance. Leonard, it's been a real pleasure.
The pleasure is mine. And you are a wonderful interlocutor, if I may say.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.